So first of all, I just want to mention that it's very natural that when things change in the sensitivity of the retreat and the quietness of the retreat, it feels a bit like a tsunami has arrived. And so some of you may be feeling that the change to the timetable, the change to the quietness of the retreat, because we have the dana and then the ceremony, and things are changing. And so some of you may be feeling a bit sensitive about all of this, and just to be aware that things do change and we can ride those waves and come back to silence. All right, come back now to silence. We return to the silent, quiet space that we were in, and we keep with that silence, both inside and outside. And it is important to keep holding the retreat and riding the changes. So this is a talk about the Yom Kippur and how that relates to our inner journey in this retreat and in our life. And it uses Yom Kippur as a kind of a model or a kind of a metaphor. And I know that some of you may feel it's very confusing because of all the associations that you might have had from your childhood and so on, of a very religious day that's full of religious associations from your parents and your grandparents and from the whole religious culture. And I would say to you that if you were in Sri Lanka or Thailand and you were a kind of grown up in a Buddhist household, you'd feel just the same, although it would be another religion, because the religions have the nature of developing form after form and layers of forms, and then they become a weight of form on us. So we can cut through it, and I think that especially today on Yom Kippur, it's very suitable actually for a relationship with the Dharma, because this is the one day in the Jewish calendar that really is not full of rituals, of history, of festival seasons, of a lot of mitzvot, of things to do, and a lot of kind of cultural associations. It's really not so much about a day about being a Jew or a religious identity as a Jew. It's much more a day of existential reality as a human being. And that's why Yom Kippur itself is a good day for us to contemplate and bring in the associations that we have in the Jewish culture, because this day is in the Jewish culture and Jewish faith a day much more of existential, of cosmic reality, of beyond time and beyond season and beyond history. So I have also must acknowledge here that a lot of my understanding, although I grew up in an Orthodox home, but I really went out of it, but a lot of my understanding of the deeper levels of all of this come from my wife, Rachel, and she in a way is a teacher for me with all of the material from the Zohar and so on. That's her world. So we work to quite well together. If any of you have partners that have nothing to do with Buddhism and nothing to do with Dharma, and you think, how is that possible? I think, it's fine. It's interesting. It's quite a good basis for a relationship. So One of the issues that is behind this day of Yom Kippur is the issue of time, because Rosh Hashanah is the day that symbolizes the creation of the world. That's Rosh Hashanah is the deep symbol on the celebration of creation. And after that, Yom Kippur arrives, which says, what do we do with this creation? What is our role? What is our relationship to creation? And the first thing that happens when we ask that question is we get very scared, because with the creation is destruction, with the creation is samsara, with the creation is the sense of our vulnerability. We realize that as we created, we're also destroyed. There's something temporary about the whole thing. So creation always brings us to a place, or very often brings us to a place of uncertainty, and this uncertainty is scary for the self. And so one of the themes of Yom Kippur is actually uncertainty, the question what will be. There is prayers about this, will I be here in 1 year's time? What is waiting for me in this coming year? These are kind of scary questions, but they're questions that that are really a kind of essence of facing our vulnerability, facing the uncertainty of life, and not running away from it, and not like the normal every day of the year in the Jewish context, which is just ordinary function and escaping. Every day of the year is ordinary day. Yom Kippur is a day when you don't do an ordinary day. You face cosmic uncertainty of I am born into this body, mind, and it's no joke. It's all uncertain, passing, and vulnerable. And in the Yom Kippur prayer book, there is a beautiful poem which is almost word for word exactly like a similar poem in the ancient Buddhist sutta, which says that our life is like a passing cloud, is like a wisp of straw, is like a dream that comes and goes in the night. And that's, you know, almost word for word, the Machzor of Yom Kippur is the same. You'll find the same poem in the ancient Buddhist teachings of 2,500 years ago. This sense of vulnerability, our life is really like a passing dream that passes in the night. So what do we do with that? And both in the Dharma and in the tradition of Yom Kippur, the first thing we do with that is stop, because we really cannot carry on business as usual faced with cosmic uncertainty. It is not business as usual anymore. And the first thing about both Yom Kippur and like the retreat we're doing and the practices we're doing and the Dharma itself is saying, in order to face cosmic uncertainty, the tendency for vulnerability, suffering, and uncertainty is just to stop. Stop running away from it. Turn towards it. And this stopping is one of the key movements in the day of Yom Kippur. And that's why I mentioned Shabbat Shabbaton. It's called Shabbat Shabbaton, the Sabbath of Sabbaths. And what is Shabbat is stopping, is Shvita, is resting, is sitting, is stopping. That's the nature of Shabbat. And this day, Shabbat Shabbaton, is the Sabbath of the Sabbath, the great stopping, if you like. And the year goes round, and Yom Kippur is not in the year. It's not a seasonal festival. It's nothing to do with seasons and with harvest and with fruits and with traditional, or the giving of the Torah, or anything. It's not seasonal. It's like a tzir. It's like a hinge in the year, a day of stopping. And stopping is really about also for us not to be business as usual in ourselves. It's the key is the stopping goes inside, and a sense of stopping being me, stopping being full of me, how we identify ourselves. I am like this, I am an accountant, I am a Dharma teacher, I am a schlepper, I am a king, I am a somebody, I am a nobody. There's a wonderful little Jewish story about a rabbi and a chazan, shliach tzibur, and a shamash, you call it? Shamash, the helper in the Beit HaKnesset. And the three of them are just before Yom Kippur, and the rabbi says, beating his chest, I am nothing, I am nothing, I am nothing. And the shliach tzibur says, I am nothing, I am nothing, I am nothing. And the shamash, the cleaner, the helper there, says, I am nothing, I am nothing. So the rabbi and the shliach tzibur turned to him and said, turned to each other and said, who is he to say he's nothing? And this day, which we in a way become nothing, we lose day. This is day of symbolizing emptiness, because it's symbolizing we drop our roles, our usual function, our usual being somebody. We are become in a way meet a certain death, a kind of a death on this day. And there are many symbols of death inside the Yom Kippur ceremony, and in that sense it's very pagan and very ancient. That's what I mentioned before, the shamanistic side. It's meeting death, it's meeting emptiness and coming out the other side. It's a day when we go into and go down into the place of nothing, or the place of emptiness. And that's its symbol, and that's the sort of hidden symbol of Yom Kippur. And of course it's what really the Buddha Dharma is about. It is reaching and touching the emptiness in us as deep truth. And so it's in all kinds of symbolic forms inside Yom Kippur. Like, I'm going to talk tomorrow about Yonah, the book that is read on the Sefer Yonah, the book of Jonah, is read on this day. And it's really about going into the emptiness, the belly of the whale, and the dark place, and empty place, and kind of going through a death and rebirth experience. And in the and in the center piece, and the most powerful piece, which you can really feel is so ancient in the Jewish tradition, with Kohen Gadol, he goes into the most holy room, and it's the one time he does that, and in the temple. And what is this room? It's just empty space. In the Kadosh Kadoshim, in the center of the temple, which is the big sacred core practice of Jewish life, was the temple practice, and this is the core and the center of it all, and it's an empty room, and that's symbolic, and that's a lot in the prayer book of Yom Kippur. The Jewish mystical tradition takes this into a very beautiful place. Because constantly, this is where the deeper level of the Jewish life really meets the Dharma in the Jewish mystical tradition, in the Zohar, for example. And because all the time, the Jewish mystical tradition says everything you do is only about the present moment. No, there's no seasonal thing. It's right now that it's happening, every moment of your life. So it brings it right into the present moment, the whole thing. For example, in the Zohar, emptiness is called is midbar, means desert. And the symbol of the desert is always the same meaning, or the implication is emptiness. And it's called a land not sown, lo zarua, eretz lo zarua. It doesn't mean eretz kaze muznach, or finished land. It's not that. It just means it hasn't been sown yet. It's like tov vavoh, it's the beginning. From tov vavoh, or chaos, comes form. So it's emptiness that gives rise to form. So eretz lo zarua, land that is unsown with seeds, is just before the sowing. So it's really, the Zohar takes this into a very interesting place of emptiness bringing form, and emptiness bringing creation and form, and puts it right in the present moment and says every minute there is midbar inside us, and every minute we are creating form. So that the constant relationship between form and emptiness is happening every minute. It's right now. It's not happened to the children of Israel, 2,000 years ago. It's not a symbol. It's actually an experience every moment. So I think that we can take that message quite deeply and personally, and what we're doing in a way is sitting, stopping, meeting empty places inside us, meeting the midbar inside us. What is our base? What is our ground of being? And we talked before about tshuva, how that's in a sense returning to something deeper in us, returning to our deeper self, our Buddha nature, our fundamental self, our ground of being. And when we do this, we return, and it's about looking in the mirror. Because also in Yom Kippur, and also what we're doing here, is we return to quiet, we stop, we return to a kind of empty, simple place, and then we look, and then what happens? A thought comes up, a feeling comes up, a pain comes up, and we're looking in the mirror. Okay, it's a thought. Okay, it's a habit. Okay, it's a pain. Okay, it's a joy. It comes and it goes. So from that place, looking in the mirror is both what symbolizes Yom Kippur, and also what symbolizes the metaphor of what we're doing here. To check who we are, to check our tendencies, to check our limitations, to check our patterns and our needs and our creation. How is it for us, the form called me, this form that is all the time being created, this form, the body mind, how is it for me? What is it? What's going on? And it's about the tshuva, the reaction to this, the response to this, which is, I think, what we're doing in the retreat. We can give it that, in a way, description coming from Yom Kippur, tshuva, return to ourselves, our awake, being awake to ourselves, is a process of seeing. It's not just a process of worrying whether we sin or we don't sin. There's a language there which is quite difficult for many people, also for me, and also for in the Buddhist tradition there really isn't a sense of sin. Sin is not a language used in the Buddhist tradition at all. There isn't that you can walk your way through 10,000 suttas of the traditional Buddhist teaching, and you will not find sin. It just isn't a concept that is held in the Buddha Dharma. But there is a sense, instead of sin, there is a sense of a cloud, a veil, or of ignorance that we simply don't see. And in the Jewish tradition, it's there. In the Jewish mystical tradition, it's any sin is regarded as the eye not seeing. I think it's a quote from Rav Kook, the early Rav Kook, who said, sin is simply the eye that doesn't see. And tshuva is opening the eye to see. And Rav Kook said it. So it's kind of in the essence of the Jewish sort of spiritual practice. And forgiveness, resetting the past, looking at the mirror and letting things go, touching our emptiness, empty place, and being all right there, not being somebody and not and being all right there, sitting in the eye of the storm, Eina Sera, sitting in the center of things and being all right there, knowing that that's our life. All of these are healing and helping us to be with the great uncertainty. All of those are, in a way, our answer to the great uncertainty, to sit quietly in the eye of the storm and learn how to do that. And I think that's what we're doing in the retreat, because we can't control the storm. The uncertainty is there, creation brings it, but we can sit in the eye of the storm, whatever is happening. Emptiness brings out form, we are with that process. The minute there is a thought, next minute there's just a breath, next minute there's quietness and not much, next minute another thought, forms are being made all the time. And our role is to watch them in the mirror and sit in the middle of that, quietly, and take and be able to be in the eye of the storm. And the second part of Yom Kippur and of what we're doing here, which will really come tomorrow, is okay. So I sit in the middle of my life. I am able to watch my life, but what do I do with it? What next? What's the direction? Where do I go with it? And that's very much a question that's asked in Yom Kippur, and very much a question that we ask in our life. And we'll start a little bit thinking about this tonight with a talk, an exercise by Zohar. It's part of the same reflection. Okay, what do I do with this one precious life? As Mary Oliver asked. What do I do with this one precious life? It's part of the same question. And it's a little bit like the story I told the other day about the Zen story, about the young person that went to find a teacher, and he met this old man with a huge bundle of sticks on his back, and he was the teacher, and he said, what's the awakening? What's release? And the teacher dropped the bundle, and then he said, and then what? And the teacher picked up the bundle again and went on walking. So they're the two sides of the practice. It's a very nice image from the Tibetan tradition of the balance between wisdom and skill in life, wisdom and upaya. And wisdom would be understanding our being with uncertainty, understanding ourselves, looking in the mirror, understanding the form called this being here. And upaya is what I do with it. What skills can I develop to be able, using this wisdom, to be able to navigate in life? Where do I go next? What job do I take? How do I relate to people, to my partner, to my family? How do I talk? How do I act? What is right living? What is right action? What is my relationship to people, to the world? So they go together. So one is the dropping the bundle, which is the wisdom, and picking up the bundle and walking on is upaya, is the skill, is what we do with it. And so they're both really a part of two sides of the same thing. They really go together constantly. As we grow in insight and we see more, so our skill in navigating this life, that develops exactly to the same extent. So we're always with the two together. So I want to just talk a little bit about what's happening in the next day for us. The retreat carries on. We are in silence. We are practicing, and this is the main theme. The form of tomorrow is not tremendously different from the form of today. There is meditations and so on. There is quite a lot of resting and lying, quite a lot, because we're fasting. So there'll be more, in a way, more resting. We get up later tomorrow. It's at 7 o'clock, I should tell you, and not at 6. 6:30. 6:30, is it? So okay, the meditation is at 7 then, right? So it's a little later. So it's really it's important that we keep our practice, and we're trying to find a delicate place where we don't suddenly start going into a lot of stuff. And so we're keeping that delicate place of silence, and we need all of your help in that, to keep the silence and the awareness and the meditative mind, the mindfulness, just keep the thread of mindfulness together. So I want to talk a little bit about fasting. Actually, in the Jewish tradition, because it's still a kind of shamanistic and ancient practice of reaching a place of emptiness in us, of zero point, fasting is still today regarded as much more important than going to the Beit HaKnesset or reading the prayer book. The fasting is like, that's the key for the day. And so I really recommend that all of us do fast, whoever can fast. It goes very well with meditation. Fasting actually goes well with meditation. Don't forget that the Buddha for 7 years more or less fasted, and his awakening came when he ate. And let's hope that tomorrow evening when we eat we'll be awakened Buddhas. The kitchen should make us kia, like the Buddha ate. But it goes well with meditation, and I want to explain that. But I should say that it's not a compulsion, it's not a must, it's not something that all of us have to do, and you are really we're not in that place of making kind of conditions that you absolutely have to do this or that, as you know. So the soft approach would say fasting is helpful and interesting, but if it's not for you, then don't feel bad. Don't feel somehow you're not getting it, or everyone else is fasting and I'm missing it. That's not the case. You make your choice. Fasting is a good thing, it's an interesting thing, but don't worry. And some of you absolutely shouldn't fast. For example, if you have medical conditions or you're taking medical drugs, then you ought to drink, at least. And so you must decide for yourselves. But I wanted to just talk a few minutes about the fasting. One of the things that really helps us in terms of fasting is the sense of, in English you call it austerity. Austerity, I don't know how you translate it in English, it's like minimal profile, being minimal, like minimal needs and really it's between that and that. Yeah. Between those two words. It's reducing the input. It's just reducing our processing of the world. It's a simplicity that reduces our needs for things, and helps us to look at our needs and brings up our needs. Most of us are never ever hungry because we eat even before while we think we might be hungry. We don't allow hunger. We eat all the time, so we're actually afraid of hunger, so we don't allow it. But hunger is a fundamental need, and say with thirst. So it's kind of meeting our needs and helping us to be humble, to be minimal profile. What's it like to be have a minimal profile, to have minimal needs, to simplify, not to consume things, not to consume anything? And we see then, it helps us to see our neediness, to see what is hunger. It's an interesting meditation on what is hunger. How is it for us? It's a really interesting thing. It's not just hunger for food. There's something in there which is primal, which is a very interesting place to see in meditation. It goes well with meditation in the sense of exposing things that we see, that helping us to see some fundamental powers, forces in us. But in the body, it helps create will and some inner power to fast. It creates some inner power in us, our ability to fast, and the process of fasting develops will and so on. So what might help us tomorrow with the fast? Firstly, I think some sense of activity. It's good to rest, and we'll be resting quite a lot, but keep going with a timetable, keep going with engagement. I'm amazed to watch sometimes people that fast and they are praying all day like crazy, non-stop praying and praying and praying, and there's something about that energy of keeping going that actually helps us to fast, rather than sort of falling into a kind of passive space of difficulty and getting, kind of in the soup. So it helps us to be engaged and involved. So the timetable is there. Please keep to the timetable. It will help us to work with fasting. The support of the Sangha is also helpful. The fact that we're all together, like in the Beit Knesset, the energy of the place, the people holding each of us. So that also helps us with fasting. No extremes. Don't push to any extreme. You can basically, in terms of the body, if there's small symptoms that you know from fasting, it's okay. It's known. Like you have a bit of a headache or a bit of a feeling weakness or whatever. That really is okay. That's just like the body cleaning itself and so on. If anything gets strong, any symptom at all, then like headache, dizziness, but it's strong, and then drink. Make sure you drink, okay? And just don't think twice. That's really all I want to say about the process And I just want to, for us, I want to read a poem, also by Mary Oliver, that just gives a kind of a poetic reflection. It's called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. But meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. It calls to you, like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. So we'll take a couple of minutes just to quiet.